Torts, 15H Edition. Chapter 3. Privileges. Narration script for audio conversion. This script is written as continuous spoken narration rather than as an outline. Part 1 narrates the non-case explanatory material introducing each of the chapter's 8 privileges. Part 2, each of the chapter's permittable cases as a plain language summary followed by an issue, rule, application, and conclusion. Speptum in flowing sentences. Chapter 3 is the defenses, or privileges, that can excuse conduct that would otherwise qualify as one of the intentional torts from Chapter 2. Consent, self-defense, defense of others, defense of property, recovery of property, necessity, authority of law. But the law recognizes a range of affirmative defenses, privileges, that reflect situations where the law has concluded the conduct was either justified or excusable. The defendant carries the burden of pleading and proving these privileges. Consent is the most foundational of these privileges, and it comes in 3 forms. Actual consent requires that the plaintiff had the capacity to consent, was free of duress or serious mistake, and was subjectively willing for the defendant's conduct to occur. Consent doesn't require desire, only willingness, the way a boxer is willing to be punched without desiring it. Apparent consent applies when the defendant reasonably, even if mistakenly, believed the plaintiff was consenting, based on the plaintiff's angry words and an error. A consent applies when the defendant reasonably, even if mistakenly, believed the plaintiff was sentence, based on the plaintiff fine and sampling. And presumed consent, sometimes called the emergency doctrine, applies when immediate action is necessary to save a person's life or health and there's no time to obtain actual consent. The courts read this doctrine narrowly. Self-defense allows a person to use reasonable force to protect against a threatened battery. The privilege exists only while the threat is ongoing, and it ends the moment the threat has passed. Using force in retaliation, after the danger is over, is a battery in its own right. A reasonable, even if mistaken, belief that force is necessary is enough to trigger the privilege. Defense of others follows a similar logic. Protecting a person who uses reasonable force to protect a third party from an imminent battery. Defense of property permits a landowner to use reasonable force to protect their property from intrusion, but the law draws a hard line. Force that is intended or likely to cause death or serious bodily harm may never be used solely to protect property, no matter how many times a person has been burglarized. Recovery of property, sometimes called the shopkeeper's privilege, allows a merchant who reasonably suspects a customer of theft to detain that person briefly for a reasonable investigation without becoming liable for false imprisonment, even if it later turns out the customer did nothing wrong. Necessity permits a person to interfere with someone else's property without their consent in order to prevent a greater harm. But as we'll see, this privilege comes in 2 importantly different flavors. Public necessity, which fully excuses the interference with no obligation to pay for the resulting damage, and private necessity, which excuses the interference from being treated as a trespass, but still requires the actor to compensate the property for any harm caused. Authority of law covers the privilege of law enforcement officers, and in limited circumstances private citizens, to use reasonable force to make an arrest, a privilege legally distinct from, though sometimes confused with, the separate doctrine of governmental or official immunity. And discipline covers the privilege of law enforcement officers and, in limited circumstances, private citizens to use reasonable force to make an arrest. Ifer can ferry furmish to private tolk in the city or to see as. With that framework in mind, let's turn to the individual cases. Valerius Meisten says, Sexton, turned, trained, transpenses and timing elements process from in Manselms, back train in decession to train factional case action 0, burn in the sidelines without complaint at the time, but Hackbart was later found to have a serious neck fracture. The trial court, while acknowledging the blow was intentional rather than accidental, ruled as a matter of law that professional football is an inherently violent business where such conduct is common, is properly policed only through penalties and expulsion under the game's own rules, and therefore cannot give rise to tort liability at all. Issue, rule, application, and conclusion. The issue was whether a professional athlete who intentionally strikes an opposing player, in a manner that violates the rules of the game and goes beyond what any player consents to by choosing to play, can be held liable in tort, or whether all such conduct is categorically shielded from liability simply because it occurs during a violent contact sport. The rule is that consent to participate in a contact sport is not unlimited consent to any and all conduct that might occur during the game. A participant consents only to the kind of contact and risk that is normal and expected within the rules and customs of the sport, not to conduct, like an intentional blow struck out of anger, well outside the run of play, that exceeds the scope of what the sport's rules and customs make routine. Applying that rule, the Tenth Circuit found that the trial court had erred by treating the violent nature of football as an automatic bar to liability, rather than asking the narrower and more precise question of whether this particular blow, intentional, unrelated to any ongoing play, and a clear violation of the game's own rules against such strikes, fell outside the scope of the risks Hackbart accepted by playing. The court's conclusion reversed the judgment for the defendant and remanded the case, holding that a jury, not the trial judge as a matter of law, should decide whether this conduct exceeded the bounds of what Hackbart consented to by participating in the game. Case, DeMay v. Roberts, Michigan, 1881, Tassel, Div. Macon, Ivriel, Big Dewitt, Axe Sermont. To help. In fact, Scattergood had no medical training or qualifications whatsoever. He remained in the room throughout the delivery, at one point even holding the laboring woman's hand during a contraction, and the woman believed him to be an assistant physician. She sued upon later discovering his true unqualified status. Issue, rule, application, and conclusion. The issue is whether a person's consent to the presence of someone she believes qualified medical assistant remains valid once she discovers that person's true unqualified identity. In other words, whether consent obtained through deception about a person's essential character or qualifications is legally effective consent at all. The rule is that consent obtained by fraud or deceit as to an essential fact, here, whether the person present had any legitimate medical role at all, is not valid consent, and the party who obtains presence or access through such deception is liable for the resulting invasion of privacy and dignity, notwithstanding the plaintiff's apparent agreement at the time. Applying that rule, the court found that the extraordinary privacy interests at stake during childbirth made this exactly the kind of occasion where a person has an especially strong right to control who is present, and that DeMay's failure to disclose Scattergood's true, unqualified character meant the woman's apparent consent to his presence was invalid from the start. The court's conclusion affirmed the judgment for the plaintiff, holding that the shame and mortification she suffered upon learning the truth were fully compensable damages, since both defendants had participated in a deceit that vitiated whatever consent had to exist at the time. Case. O'Brien v. Cone Nalms at the case by Eris's when I'm wearing from low. 2-1. Case, well, Brian VC and I test a controller. Case is what is that process to Z 1991. She watched the line of women pass before the ship's surgeon, understood what was happening, and when her turn came, held up her bare arm to him without a word of objection, even after mentioning she had been vaccinated before. She was vaccinated, developed a serious reaction, and later sued, claiming she had never actually consented and that the vaccination was therefore a battery. Issue, rule, application, and conclusion. The issue is whether a defendant can be shielded from battery liability based on the plaintiff's outward conduct suggesting consent, even if the plaintiff did not, in fact, subjectively wish to be touched. The rule is that a defendant's conduct is lawful, and the defense of apparent consent applies whenever the plaintiff's overt behavior, her actions and outward manifestations, not her private, unexpressed feelings, would lead a reasonable person in the defendant's position to believe she was consenting. The surgeon is entitled to rely on what he could see and observe, not on what the silent inside. Applying that rule, the court found that the plaintiff had stood in the vaccination line with the other women, watched them being vaccinated one by one, said nothing to indicate unwillingness, and voluntarily extended her arm when her turn came. Conduct that would lead any reasonable observer to conclude she was consenting to the procedure, regardless of what she may have privately wished. The court's conclusion affirmed judgment for the defendant, establishing the doctrine of apparent consent. A defendant who reasonably relies on a plaintiff's outward conduct is protected from liability, even if it later turns out the plaintiff did not actually wish to be touched. Case, Moore v. Williams, in Alden, 1905, Assembly. A patient consulted an ear specialist about trouble with her right ear and consented to an operation on that ear specifically. Once she was under anesthesia, the surgeon examined her more closely, decided the right ear did not actually require surgery after all, but discovered a more serious condition in her left ear.
an ear she had not complained about and had not consented to have operated on. Without waking her to ask permission, he proceeded to operate on the left ear instead. The surgery was skillfully performed and medically successful, but the patient sued for battery because he had operated on a body part she never authorized.
Issue, rule, application, and conclusion. The issue was whether a surgeon who performs a successful, skillfully executed operation on a different body part than the one the patient actually consented to can nonetheless be liable for battery simply because the specific procedure exceeded the scope of the patient's consent. The rule is that consent to a particular medical procedure does not constitute consent to a different, unauthorized procedure, even a related or arguably beneficial one. A physician who operates beyond the scope of what was actually authorized commits a battery regardless of the surgeon's skill or the medical success of the unauthorized procedure, even a related or arguably beneficial one. A physician who operates beyond the scope of what was actually authorized procedure can place Tokelimary as...
Applying that rule, the court found that the patient's diseased left ear was not discovered in the course of the authorized operation on the right ear, but through a separate examination after the surgeon had already decided the right ear surgery was unnecessary. And there was no evidence this was such an emergency that immediate surgery without any chance to ask the patient or her family was truly required. The court also rejected the argument that the presence of the patient's family physician, who raised no objection, constituted implied consent on her behalf, since he had not been authorized to consent to any change in the surgical plan. The court's conclusion affirmed that this was a battery as a matter of law and sent the case back for the jury to resolve the amount of damages, establishing that operating outside the scope of statutory consent is actionable regardless of the outcome's medical sequacity. K.S. Rondini v. Bunn, D. Alla, 2020. 20-year-old Megan Rondini met 34-year-old Terry Bunn Jr. at a bar. He drove her first to her apartment and then to his own home, where the two had drinks and he invited her to his bedroom. What happened next was sharply disputed. Bunn maintained the two had consensual sex. Rondini's later account to police described a non-consensual sexual assault, and she went to police shortly after the encounter. Rondini died by suicide roughly 7 months later. Her parents brought civil claims for assault and battery on her behalf, and the defendant moved for summary judgment, arguing the undisputed evidence showed consensual sex. Issue, rule, application, and conclusion. The issue was whether summary judgment for the defendant was appropriate where the parties offered starkly conflicting accounts of whether the sexual contact was consensual. In other words, whether the question of consent on this record was one the court could resolve as a matter of law or had to go to a jury. The rule is that the presence or absence of consent to sexual contact is a factual question for the jury whenever the evidence is genuinely disputed. Neither physical nor verbal resistance is legally required to establish an absence of consent, and consent to one form of contact does not imply consent to a substantially different one. A defendant is not entitled to summary judgment simply by offering his own version of a contested encounter. Applying that rule, the Federal District Court found that the plaintiffs and the defendant offered fundamentally incompatible accounts of the same encounter, with Rondini's contemporaneous statements to police describing an assault and the defendant describing consensual sex, a direct factual conflict that could not be resolved by the court on the papers alone. The court's conclusion denied summary judgment, holding that whether the contact was assault and battery was a question properly reserved for a jury to decide after hearing and weighing the conflicting evidence, rather than a question the court could dispose of at the summary judgment stage. Haugen in weighing the conflicting evidence, rather than a question the court could dispose of at the summary judgment stage. Herrenston 4, defense of property hour. After boarding up windows and posting no trespassing signs failed to stop the intrusions, they rigged a loaded shotgun to the bedroom door of the house, wired so it would fire automatically into the legs of anyone who opened the door, with no warning of the trap posted anywhere, and the gun itself hidden from view. The plaintiff, breaking into the house to steal old bottles and jars he considered antiques, opened the bedroom door and was shot, resulting in the loss of much of his leg and a permanent injury. A jury awarded him both substantial actual and punitive damages, and the property owner... Issue, rule, application, and conclusion. The issue was whether a landowner may lawfully use a deadly mechanical device, such as a spring gun, to protect unoccupied property against trespassers and thieves, when no human life is actually in danger. The rule is that a property owner may use only reasonable, non-deadly force to protect property from a trespasser or thief, Force intended or likely to cause death or serious bodily injury may never be used solely to protect property, no matter how persistent or frustrating the trespassing has become, because the law values human life and limb above the mere protection of unoccupied real estate and personal belongings. Applying that rule, the court found that the spring gun was deliberately set with the specific intent to seriously injure whoever opened that door, aimed low at the suggestion of one defendant specifically to hit the legs rather than the torso, and that this intentional deadly level of force could never be justified merely to protect an unoccupied, boarded-up farmhouse from theft of old bottles and jars, however sympathetic the defendant's years of frustration with break-ins might be.
The court's conclusion affirmed the jury's verdict for the plaintiff, including both actual and punitive damages, establishing firmly that deadly force may never be used solely in defense of property, even against someone who is, in fact, committing a criminal trespass. Trestand 5, recover of property and shopkeeper's privilege, the right to detain a suspected shoplifter briefly for a reasonable investigation, even though the detention occurred after she had physically left the premises.
Issue, rule, application, and conclusion. The issue was whether the shopkeeper's privilege to detain a suspected thief for reasonable investigation extends beyond the physical boundaries of the store itself to cover a detention that occurs just after the suspect has already left the premises. The rule the Michigan Supreme Court adopted, extending beyond even what the restatement had addressed, is that a merchant is privileged to detain a person for a reasonable investigation using reasonable non-excessive force whenever the merchant reasonably believes the person has unlawfully taken store merchandise. And this privilege can extend to a detention occurring in the immediate vicinity just after the person has left the premises, where the merchant may not have had a reasonable opportunity to form an act on that belief before the customer walked out the door. Applying that rule, the court reasoned that requiring a merchant to either confront a suspected shoplifter while still inside the store, before having adequate grounds to form a reasonable belief, or else lose the privilege entirely once the person steps outside, placed merchants in an unfair and impractical bind, especially given how serious and costly shoplifting is for the retail industry as a whole. The court's conclusion reversed and remanded the case for a new trial, holding that the jury should determine, first, whether the store's agent reasonably believed the plaintiff had taken merchandise, and if so, whether the resulting investigation and brief detention were conducted reasonably under all the circumstances, extending the shopkeeper's privilege to cover detentions occurring just after a suspect leaves the store, not only those that occur strictly on the premises.
Liria, California, 1853.
The rule the California Supreme Court applied, the doctrine of public necessity, is that the right to destroy property to stop a raging fire traces back to the fundamental law of necessity. A burning building, or one in the direct path of a fire, becomes in that moment a public nuisance which it is lawful to abate, and the private rights of the individual property owner must yield to the safety of the broader community. Unlike private necessity, this doctrine provides a complete defense with no obligation to compensate the property owner for the resulting destruction. Applying that rule, the court found that the destruction of the plaintiff's house, ordered in good faith during an actual, raging conflagration and for the specific purpose of protecting the surrounding city from the fire spread, fell squarely within this doctrine of necessity, regardless of whether, in hindsight, the fire might not have actually reached that particular building, or whether the plaintiffs might have saved more of their belongings with a few more minutes. The court's conclusion reversed the judgment for the plaintiffs, holding that a good faith, reasonable exercise of the necessity privilege during an actual public emergency as a complete defense to what would otherwise be a trespass or conversion. Case, Vincent v. Lake Erie Transpaco. Minimization, necessary privilege during an actual public emergency. Because of after the text of fours and other bonds with a few more minutes. The court's conclusion reversed the judgment for the plaintiff's house, ordered in good faith during an actual raging conflagration and for the specific purpose of protecting the surrounding city from the fire spread, fell squarely within this doctrine of necessity, regardless of whether in hindsight the fire might not have actually reached that particular building, or whether the plaintiffs might have saved more of their belongings with a few more minutes. The court's conclusion reversed the judgment for the plaintiff's house, ordered in good faith during an actual public emergency, completely excuses the destruction, without any obligation to pay compensation. Establishing the doctrine of necessity, regardless of whether, in hindsight, the fire might not have actually reached that particular building, or whether the plaintiffs might have saved more of their belongings with a few more minutes. The court's conclusion reversed the judgment.
The defendant's steamship was moored at the plaintiff's dock to unload cargo when a violent storm developed, with winds reaching 50 miles per hour and continuing to intensify through the night. Rather than risk sailing away into the dangerous storm, the ship's crew deliberately kept the vessel tied fast to the dock, replacing mooring lines as they wore through or broke throughout the night. The continued pounding of the ship against the dock as it was thrown about by the wind and waves caused $500 in damage to the dock. The trial court found the crew had exercised prudent seamanship and good judgment in choosing to keep the ship moored rather than risk sailing into the storm, and a jury awarded the dock owner's damages anyway. The shipping company appealed, arguing that since its conduct was entirely reasonable and necessary given the emergency, it could not be held liable at all. Issue, rule, application, and conclusion. The issue was whether a party who reasonably and necessarily uses another's property to protect its own more valuable property during an emergency, here deliberately keeping a ship moored to a dock during a dangerous storm, rather than risking the open water, must nonetheless compensate the property owner for resulting damage, even though the conduct itself was entirely prudent and non-negligent. The rule, sometimes called the doctrine of private necessity or incomplete privilege, is that a party facing an emergency may lawfully use or interfere with another's property to protect life or a more valuable property from a greater harm, and doing so is not a trespass. But unlike the public necessity, this privilege is only an incomplete one. The party is still obligated to pay compensation for whatever damage results from the interference, because the necessity, however reasonable, is invoked for the actor's own private necessity or incomplete privilege as that a party becomes through in nominals.
Applying that rule, the court found that the crew had acted with entirely prudent seamanship in choosing to keep the ship fastened to the dock rather than risk sailing into the storm. This was not an act of negligence at all. But that this same decision was made deliberately, for the sole purpose of protecting the defendant's own valuable ship at the direct expense of the plaintiff's dock, which absorbed the resulting damage. The court's conclusion affirmed the damages award for the dock owners, that even where a party's emergency use of another's property is entirely reasonable and non-negligent, and even where the interference itself is privileged and not a trespass, the party who benefits from that necessity must still compensate the partner for the resulting harm. The classic illustration of an incomplete privilege, and a doctrine frequently contrasted with the complete defense own valuable ship, at the time in our mind.
Geary just above. U. Ellison decision for Kafter 3. The next chapter in the casebook, Chapter 4, covers negligence and the element of breach of duty, beginning with the historical development of the reasonable person standard.